Goethe versus Darwin, the economy of forms or the nature of imperialism. It is difficult to find exactly one point in time which marks the separation of the two worlds. One of these worlds you call the external world, in which you have an absolute belief, beyond a shadow of a doubt. The other is the internal world, which you do not consider worthwhile mentioning. You signify the difference between the external world and the internal world as a difference between subjective experience and products of the human mind. As subjective experience is something we seem to share with animal, it serves no purpose but a mere in-between state of human inferiority. The entire world basically consists, in your view, of three worlds that seemingly interact with each other. For the sake of clarity, I will cite your model here. World 3. The products of the human mind, the works of art and of science, including technology, human language, is there any other, theories of self and death, stories, explanatory mites, tools and scientific theories. World 2. The world of subjective experience. Conscience of self and death, sentience, animal consciousness, mental states, psychological dispositions, and unconscious states. World 1, the world of physical objects, living organisms, the heavier elements, liquids and crystals, hydrogen and helium, and the universe of physical entities. It is not a coincidence that you have placed World 3 at the chronological top of the world 1 and 2, as you clearly believe it to be the highest advanced world within this hierarchical model. It is also quite clear in this model that sentience belongs to something that humans and animals share, as all kinds of mental states, psychological dispositions, and unconscious states are shared animalism. World 2 represents the internal world. The inferiority of World 2 is one of the reasons why you are not interested in a theory of art or a theory of communication. However, what I will show here is that the world you have separated never actually needed to be separated for the sake of science. Its separation is part of a justification process that does not criticize the foundation of science, but, on the contrary, eliminates the source of this discussion. For this reason, I want to take you a bit further, backwards, of course, in your opinion, into the work of one scientist who was falsified in his individual work on the natural sciences, not because he was wrong, but because the connection between the internal world and the external world in the application of natural sciences simply meant a lid on the justification for expanding into industrialism. For this example, I want to show you that what you consider as a scientific refutation in reality serves as pretty much an ideological selective process. I'm writing about Goethe. Yes, he. Though Goethe became famous for his literary capacity, much of his scientific work concerning the natural sciences went unnoticed. One of the reasons for this lack of acknowledgement could be viewed a result of the methods he applied, but in your work it is not so much his method that you criticize, but his downfall towards panpsychism. This mysterious thing of the internal world experience seemingly prevents scientists from seeing the objective truth. Strangely, Goethe was an enormous pursuer of truth. However, he looked for sources of truth rather than justifications. He shared this enthusiasm with Herder, to whom he frequently wrote about his discoveries in anatomy. Herder had an equal love for Origen, which he had expounded in an essay on the origin of language. On the surface, this enthusiasm must have looked like an alchemic euphoria to you, for instance. I discovered it, neither gold nor silver, but what gives the unspeakable joy, the os intermaxillare, the jawbone, in the human being. It will give you pleasure as well, as it is the true keystone to the whole. It is not absent, it is present. This particular jawbone, which Goethe detected in both man and animal, opened up an entire range of philosophical possibilities about the unity and differentiation of forms. Unlike Darwin, who deduced sources in time where the origin of species was concerned, Goethe looked for the origins in shapes and forms, quite in the tradition with Husserl's phenomenology. Goethe would, for instance, describe the shape of plants as what could be seen as the beginning of iodetic reduction. However, as a matter of importance, Goethe's views were more directed towards iodetic change rather than reduction. This because he remained with the notion of source and origin. Changes in shape appeared from a common source, though unknown, but most importantly, always present in space rather than in time. The concept has much more application than reduction does. Because of the differences on the soil, it is possible for the genus, the sexe, to change onto the sort into the variety, and by the factors of the environment, these can change infinitely. Now, as a mere matter of scientific concern, Goethe was criticized later because little was known about the genetic crossings between plants. The fact that plants multiplied by fertilizing each other was unknown to Goethe. However, his view did not exclude the possibility of fertilization, though multiplying did not seem to be his main concern where variety mattered. Here, you must also keep in mind that the differences between nature and culture, the boundaries between those two, stem from a much later date. Goethe viewed the world as a whole, and not as a split image. It seems a little strange, but if we look at the consequences of the split between nature and culture, some of the notion that Goethe detected would have been, are in fact, very applicable today within the field of individual body perception. We know now, for instance, that sex does not serve as a mere function of multiplicity. The urge by individuals on account of their individual body perceptions to have sex changes, transsexuals, have created indeed an entirely new variety of the sort. Whether this possibility is genetic or not, or cultured, does not withstand Goethe's views of the capacity of infinite change. In short, he would have been right today. In fact, the more oppressed genders are desperately fighting today to gain recognition for the mere fact of their existence, as it has been ruled out by ontogenetic views that the purpose of sexuality is more a biological or a religious function to serve multiplicity. In fact, the entire discussion between essentialists and constructivists is based on this ontogenetic view. Goethe, unaware of this biological curse, which was to be imposed on plants, humans, and animals, kept looking for the origin which allowed variety rather than reproduction. Being in Sicily in July 1786, he wrote to Mrs. von Stein that he had observed shapes as the thing with which nature's sword constantly plays and thereby creates an infinite variety, looking for a sensual form of a supersensual primeval plant. And because of this multiple variable nature of his search, he could never fix this origin, as he wrote more desperately. There has to be only one, or else how could I know that this form or another is a plant, if they are not at all formed according to the same pattern? It seems a mere change of accentuation that focuses on the thoughts of Goethe in his quests for origin and infinite variety. Indeed, it seems futile, and maybe Goethe would have been shocked by the idea of transsexuality, though probably less that historians of a certain kind like to believe. We can be fairly sure, however, that society would not have accepted the idea of transsexuality, albeit as priests wearing dresses. Much of what Goethe has questioned seems to be rationally explained away nowadays. Merleau-Ponty did extensive work on the perception of the body and the development of categories to explain why Goethe was able to recognize a plant as a plant. And it seems to be sufficient an explanation not to bother with the question anymore. One can easily say, in accordance with your tradition of falsification, that Goethe looked for the wrong thing, what he calls the only one, or what might be called the source of it all. Further suggestion towards this end seems to come from Goethe's views concerning the composition of the color white. He refused stubbornly to accept Newton's experiments that showed that white, in fact, is a mixture of all spectral pure colors in equal quantities. Goethe used self-made colors in his experiments and found that the best he could do was a gray shade, thereby denouncing Newton's theory. Where colors were concerned, Goethe remained attached to a somewhat older idea, which explained white as without color, but as a reflection of light. According to Goethe, intensity of colors depended on a spectrum between dark and light, and a spectrum of shades between those two opposites. It seems to be a story that equally reminds us of Kepler, who was convinced that the planet could be traveled in a circular way and never realized that it could also be parabolic. Nevertheless, Goethe's theories on color did open up another field of natural science than that of Newton, and the grades of shade as a reflection of light turned out to be photography. One might even say, would these theories have been refuted completely, which officially they were, and still in a sneering way, photography would not exist nowadays. The fact of the matter remains that the justification of Goethe's theory could have been upheld only in a field of knowledge in which the senses would have been replaced by a technocratic device, like the ones that make sex changes possible or that make photography possible. I hold that the justification of modern theories in this sense, as well as your principle of rationality, has little to do with truth. As I shown in the above story, it rather rests on how to do away with bodily sensation or replace it by a machine-created observation. For Goethe, basic forms were not biological construction, neither representation, but literally sensible things. In fact, in this sense, he could be called an early postmodernist. Goethe enters your work only slightly. It seems unfair that I strike you in the face with this work. But it is precisely for that reason I mention him. His views, indeed, at least, never reached your field of scientific rationality. He appears in a footnote as one who greatly influenced Schopenhauer. You did not even mention his scientific work, but suggest that Goethe's literary work is responsible for Schopenhauer's mistakes. And you summarize his entire approach as panpsychism. The definition you give of panpsychism is a little thin, that is... Panpsychism is a very ancient theory. Traces of it can be found in the earliest Greek philosophers, who are often described as hylozoists, that is, as holding that all things are animate. Aristotle reports that he thought everything is full of gods. This may, Aristotle suggests, be a way to say that the soul is mingled with everything in the whole universe, including what we usually regard as inanimate matters. After showing very little of the influence of panpsychism, no more than a sketch of the scientists who have been influenced by this, you do away with it, using three arguments by concluding that 1. That there is something in evolutionary history which preceded, in some sense, the mental process, that is trivial as well as vague. But to insist that this something is mind-like and that it can even be attributed to atoms is misleading and vague. 2. That assuming pre-psychological processes to be physical processes is not very clear in panpsychism, and there can be little doubt that dreaming is conscious, but only on a level of consciousness. It is a far cry from a dream to a critical evaluation and revision of a difficult argument. And last but not least, 3. Although there exists, no doubt, something that may be described as an unconscious memory, that is, memory of which we are not aware, there cannot be, you propose, consciousness of awareness without memory. And then, finally, you conclude thus, we should not assign insight states or mental states or conscience states to atoms. The emergence of consciousness is a problem that cannot be avoided or mitigated by a panpsychist theory. Panpsychism is baseless. But my dear Sir Carl, this conclusion is equally based on your own suppositions about sources and processes. You are, as you yourself stated, a Gnostic. Of course you reject panpsychism. However, as an anthropologist, I can assure you that there's a hell of a lot more to the story than your rather oversimplified reductionism of the entire phenomena. And, as I argue, there are more ways than one to reach Rome for a good reason. Let us have another look at Goethe and see what else has been refuted, condemned, as an ended quest and flushed down the toilet of rational sciences. Goethe indeed resisted the one-sided split between the idea and experience. He was convinced that the nature works according to ideas, such as man follows an idea in everything he does, in his own words. Then how did you get this far? They say you have done it well. My child, I have done cleverly. I only thought of the thinking. The general idea behind this mode of thinking became known as idealistic morphology. One could classify the view as something that looks for a spirit behind every natural process. But that, I think, would do Goethe an injustice. He rather worked from the supposition of an idea as something with a nameless origin, instead of something as a constructed origin. And at least he never tried to escape the seemingly dogmatic discussion between universalists and pluralists by simply eliminating the first questions of an observation. This quest for origin would never leave Goethe. And because of it, he realized that even streams of thinking in his time, which could be viewed as opposing each other, would still be confronted with the same problem, as he writes in Aphorisms. Those who I will call universalists are convinced that everywhere everything can be found, albeit with endless deviations and in endless pluralism. The others, who I would call pluralists, admit the main point in general and, yes, also direct their perception towards the point, as well as their teachings, but they continuously want to discover exceptions where the type is not fully conceived, and they are right in this sense. Their mistake, however, is that they do not recognize the basic form where this one is disguised and reject this where it hides. This escapism of both pluralist and universalist could equally apply on the elimination of the individual body perception as a source of scientific probing. You yourself, I must admit, connected universalism and particularism in a clever way through a theory of refutation, but it did not guarantee recognition of individual perception in its manifold ways. On the contrary, it viewed it as something which could be overcome at all costs, serving the formulation of general laws or hypotheses. Unity has a special meaning where Goethe is concerned. What appears to be one-folded is indeed many-folded. In this lies a crucial problem of generalization, as it exists but ever and never does at the same time. Or, as Goethe writes in Epiphyrema, when observing nature, one always has to accept one as many. Nothing is internal, nothing is external. Then what is internal is external. Like this one catches with ease holy public secrets. Rejoice in the true pretense and the gravest game. No living thing is ever one, it is always many. Now here the idea of metamorphosis is expressed most explicitly by Goethe's combination that reveal the hidden contradiction between the internal-external split of the world, as he talks about public secrets, true pretense, gravest games and such. His idea of origin does not serve as a justification of the animus behind the material thing, but as a guarantee for the many shapes it thereby endorses and allows. This, of course, is central to the mere thought of metamorphosis, that is, things change, and they do so continuously. It also reveals the contradiction in fixating the form or shape of a phenomena, because whatever shape it takes, its capacity to change and transform itself makes the secret of origin ever unrevealed. Especially on typologies, Goethe reveals his innermost thoughts about what actually rules the universe, and he concludes it must be differentiation of shape. For this purpose, he formulated a special law which can be seen as an economy of forms. A concept which never again re-entered the natural sciences in or natural history. Observing the long neck of a giraffe, for instance. With this observation, we encounter the rule that no part can gain something extra without withdrawing something from another part, and vice versa. Here, the boundaries of natures are revealed, in which the shaping power seems to move in the most amazing and almost unmotivated manner, while at the same time unable to break the circle. This shaping urge is both a bordered and well-organized empire, a ruler by its own. The categories of the budget in which it needs to divide its dividends are prescribed. Whatever it would like to spend on anybody allows it free to a certain extent. This economy prevents nature from going bankrupt. So, what exactly has ended by your refutation of panpsychism? First of all, one has to wonder whether the fundamentals of panpsychism concerned with animate matter are that dominating. We have to look a little beyond the origin and sources to know if the literal meaning concerning everything is full of gods, as expressed by Aristotle, really is the essence of its line of thinking. Whatever you would like it to call, Within panpsychic view, it is characterized first of all as a disembodiment, absence of an identifiable source and presence of a mystery. In your view, such a hypothesis is a religious dogma which, once refuted, will make way for the objective truth. In my view, of course, it is an expression of a social source which is present in society. These social sources are less coincidental and less unmotivated as you propose, which becomes clear if we look at later developments, by asking what has replaced the notion of the economy of forms, but remained what I would like to call the economy of the body. This economy of the body serves more as a production or reproduction mechanism in science than it serves a scientific understanding. It should not be a surprise that Darwin studied the work of Jean-Baptiste Lamarck between 1828 and 1831. Lamarck's views were consistent with Goethe's views. He believed that the long neck of a giraffe was the result of a different application towards using the body. He believed that giraffes needed to reach higher and higher to gain their food and thereby learn to use their bodies differently, then passing it on to the next generation. The concept of genetics did not exist as such yet. Darwin basically observed the breeding programs applied by horse owners and realized that in breeding the fastest horses, a principle of selection was used. Simultaneously, Thomas Malthus published On the Growth of the World Population in Relation to War, Hunger and Plagues. These three burdens of mankind, according to Malthus, in fact prevented the world from being overpopulated. After reading Thomas Malthus' work, Darwin concluded that the breeding selection program of horse owners functioned in the same way as nature. Hence, the concept of the survival of the fittest was born. When Darwin published his Origin of Species in 1859, he was not attacked because of the ethics which might have concerned the concept of the fittest. I've always wondered how. Even if Darwin's theory seemed to apply for nature and breeding programs, would not create some sort of protest within the God-fearing people about the relative cruelty of this principle of survival? Instead, Darwin was criticized by the Bishop of Oxford, Samuel Wilberforce, for his notion of origin. The internal familiarity between people and apes was what shocked the church. The cruelty of the survival principle had since long been the predestination by the gods. All Darwin did by introducing this idea was replacing the cruelty of the gods by a form of biological functionalism, which in itself must have been quite a moral relief to many priests. Through scientific growth, the origin of species seemed to be refuted from an inanimate soul into a biological material functionism, but at the same time it confirmed a moral justification of the economic developments within society. And by that you must agree that a refutation of some sort can be a confirmation of another. To say at least your method is not waterproof or airtight in this sense, it seems to be as deductive as it is inductive. Further development of this biological functionalistic notion also shows that the inanimate principle ruling organism did not disappear quite as much as you suppose. This appears mostly in fascinating peculiarities that are described as characteristics of living organism. In quite a number of encyclopedia, one can read that living organisms are possessed by a powerful urge for expansion. They seem to be absorbed by the battle of existence, the need to multiply in order to survive. I find it very unlikely that such reification are mere matters of discourse. It reminds me very much of the language used in the Dutch weather reports during the war in the Gulf. Suddenly the tone changed from clouds drifting in from the east to clouds invading the country from the east. These discourses, to which you simply refuse to give attention in your work, point towards a link between objective signs and social events. Darwin's views might have been bad for the authority of the church, where man was supposedly created by God, but they served pretty good as a justification for Western industrial and overseas expansion. Now, religion was not the only commodity suited for justified expansion. A whole new system of justification had replaced church enterprise. Expansion from the West was a matter of biological functionalism, and it is therefore not so surprising that Darwin's theories could be adopted as a measurement for unfit, primitive, the inferior, that could now be oppressed, fully justified. Next to this, evolution theory built on the survival of the species could work by economizing the individual body. This body economy stands in opposition to Goethe's economy of forms. And indeed, since then, nature has become very close to going bankrupt as a result of expansive exploitation. What would have been the result of Goethe's economy of forms? Now, that is a matter for speculation, but it might have resulted in a little less destructions of everything that stands in the way of capitalist expansion. First of all, I think that Goethe's idea, and those of his contemporaries, never, as you proposed, needed to be refuted in the first place. The panpsychic effect that you seem to view as subjective had everything to do with the man's place in the world. As I just showed you, so did the origin of species. All science seems to come forth using some principle of other or reification. In fact, it is part of their method in abstracting anything. In this sense, evolutionism and panpsychism do not differ at all. The source or the origin of phenomena seems at least to be serving as some method of justification. The question is whether the one justification is better than the other. Goethe's ideas on the metamorphoses and changes at least gave room for infinite variety. Goethe, however, looked for variety in forms, while Darwin looked for variety in external conditions. Goethe looked at forces stemming from the internal world, while Darwin looked at forces imposed on by the external world. The main difference between the two lines of reasoning is that the economy of forms showed a principle based on simultaneous existences of different shapes, while the survival of the fittest shows a principle based on the exclusion of contents. Darwin, of course, was not responsible for the application of social Darwinism. Neither was Marx for the Soviet Union, but I guess you don't want to know about all that. All of these scientists operated in a social historical fields which is marked by the growth of civil society, secularization, citizenship, and, most of all, moral civility versus church hegemony, as Weber would tell. It could never genuinely reveal the source of its justification, most aptly because justification needs exactly that, reified sources of disembodiment. I was therefore not surprised that disembodiment, you would call it unembodied products, played such an important role in your establishment of the external world. Neither was I surprised that you completely fall back on Darwin's evolutionary concepts to prove the irrelevancy of an internal world. It would have been mere and plain shift of authority from the gods to the genes without your notion of disembodiment. I argued yet that it is still no more than just that. So let us have a look at the way you introduce disembodiment. Here, I will refer again to your model as well as your adoption of evolutionism. Your description of that, what you will call World 3, seems valid as it points towards process of interaction rather than models of reality. You describe it as follow. By World 3, I mean the world of products and human minds, such as stories, explanatory myths, tools, scientific theories, whether true or false, scientific problems, social institutions, and works of arts. World 3 objects are of our own making, although they are not always the result of planned production by individual man. Many of World 3 objects exist in the form of material bodies and belong, in a sense, both to World 1 and World 3. Examples of sculptures, paintings, and books, whether devoted to a scientific subject or to literature, a book is a physical object and therefore belongs to World 1. But what makes it a significant production of the human mind is its content, that which remains invariant in the various copies and editions, and this content belongs to World 3. So far, so good. It's quite obvious that we interact with some of the products we create, and that these products are material products. But this in itself tells us very little of their origin. For their origin, you created a brilliant solution that fully supports your theory of falsification. Here, you acknowledge for the first time the existence of mental states, but behold, not as a sensuous impulse, but as a result of an interactive evolutionary process between the brain and language, by stating that how did the brain emerge? My guess is that it was the emergence of human language which created a selection pressure under which the cerebral cortex emerged, and with it the human consciousness of self. And you truly go out of your way to eliminate the senses as well as individual perception by turning self-conscious into a survival strategy in dealing with an external world created by the selection pressure of language. Excuse me for my deluded sarcasm, but I cannot imagine a greater trick for turning people's internal world, as well as their bodily expressions, into phenomena of control from an external world in which language becomes a biological environment. And you still go further, because ideas of which the origin does not fit into your model of interaction are literally constructed by you as external phenomena. For instance, by calling these ideas unembodied World 3 objects, or, as you say, the main reason why I consider the existence of unembodied World 3 objects is this. If unembodied World 3 objects exist, then it can no longer be a true doctrine that our grasp or understanding of World 3 objects always depends upon our sensual contact with its material embodiment. My thesis is that the human mind grasps World 3 objects, if not always directly, then by indirect method, a method which is independent of their embodiment, abstracts from the fact of their embodiment. Hooray! You truly eliminated the human body as a source of intellect. Now we can really enjoy an intellectual God which selects whether we live or die. Or do we? Of course we do not. What you created here is a human body with a consciousness of self, whose development is entirely dependent on the external world, which you feel to be so important. A body which has no internal world of any importance, but most of all whose physical and sensual experience will not be able to refute the theories of scientific rationality. As a matter of information, Goethe was, whether or not this should be called panpsychism, less convinced than you on the existence of an unembodied world three products. Neither did he look upon the idea, nor the spirit, as a sole creative force behind the world. He writes in Faust, Faust opens a volume of the New Testament and looks at it. It says here, in the beginning there was the Word. Here I already hesitate. Who will come to my assistance? I cannot estimate the world to be so high a validity. I have to view it differently. If I would be truly enlightened by the Spirit, hence, as it says, in the beginning there was the sense. But view the first sentence and ensure that your feather is not too hasty. Is it a sense which creates and activates everything? It should be, in the beginning there was strength. Though, writing this down, something already warns me that it will not be as such. The Spirit helps me. Suddenly I see the need. And conciliated I write down, in the beginning there was the deed. Now this is of course but one translation of Goethe's work, and I was not surprised to find that the official translation pointed out to me by my dear departed friend Walter Spitz showed a disembodied modern version of the Faustus, in which the sense had been replaced by the mind, the validity by price, strength by force, and need, the German word Rat, which is literally advice, by exact, and deed by act. The translation of such word raises questions about the suitability of modern discourse. Indeed, the highest price of rationality is given to the exact performance. It is no longer what we do or how we feel that matters, but how we act and how we perform. In this sense, the source from which modern discourse derives its acknowledgement very much lies at the bottom of your theories concerning the nature of science and language, the idea of performance, performing well or not, is part of a mathematical consideration of function. Which function? That of efficiency, which in turn implies the notion of a system, not just a system, but, as Léotard reminds us, the idea of performance employs a highly stable system because it is based on the principle of a relation, which is, in theory, always calculable, between heat and work, hot source and cold source, input and output. It functions as a natural scientific system, as does the survival of the fittest. Imposed, however, on the notion of society, its implication becomes horrifying in its aspect of control. Some of us perform well with words, the others I found in your theory of language to be children and other primitives.